From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections. Our connection this hour will be made in November, Election Day coming up again. There are certain political offices where the incumbents might feel like they are constantly running for re-election, but such is the nature when you're running every couple of years. And we have one of the incumbents in office with us today. Now, our pledge to our listeners on Connections is that we try to bring in office holders, their challengers, folks running for prominent political offices, to hear them at length, give you a chance to interact with them, talk about their plans, policies, proposals, etc. And today we're glad to have Senator Ted O'Brien, state senator, in the studio with us, the incumbent, the Democrat, who has a lot going on himself, even though the session ended at you never really sort of stop running and working, I guess, Ted.
I think that's right, Evan, and thanks for having me on the show. I'm really looking forward to it.
Is it always is it a continuous campaign when it's every 2 years? Does it feel that way?
It pretty much is. I like the interaction with people, so it's not something I shy away from. In fact, the most rewarding thing for me in the job is interaction with individuals who are very passionate about trying to make the world a better place, and I like that.
We're going to be talking to Ted's opponent, Republican Rich Funke, we hope next week on this program, but we'll keep you updated as to when we nail that down. But we've been trying to arrange that visit. That'll be coming up soon here. We are almost into September. It always feels like after Labor Day, people get locked back in. But this has been a sort of a busier summer than most. Do you feel like voters are starting to tune back in, or when you talk to people, is it still kind of the haze of summer, Ted?
Well, maybe because I'm so intimately involved, it certainly feels like we're fully engaged already. And maybe there's been an awful lot in the news. And I think that people are beginning to turn in already, which is a little early.
50% of people haven't heard of Moreland based on some surveys, Ted. So there's still a big chunk of folks just kind of coming back out of the...
Still room for growth.
Out of the cocoon. So you have a lot going on here. You've announced that you want to run on the upstate tax relief ballot line. Did I get the correct line there?
That's right. Upstate tax relief. And the reason for that is, and as you know, Evan, I grew up in this community. I've lived my entire life in this region. And one of the things that I think I recognize and a lot of people recognize is one of the biggest impediments to our being able to flourish as a region has been the tax climate, and particularly property taxes. My own neighbor lived next door to me for over 20 years, loved his home, loved our neighborhood, felt that he couldn't pay the taxes anymore, and the burden was just too crushing, moved out of town. And unfortunately, that's not an isolated incident. Small businesses are impacted. Too many middle-class and lower-income people just really struggling with the tax burdens. And so I've made it a priority, not only during my term during the Senate, but also in the county legislature, about trying to find ways to turn around the tax climate upstate that I think has really been a real obstacle to our growth. And one of the ways to highlight that is with creating a party line that is devoted to upstate tax relief.
Is it a gimmick, or is it a legitimate exercise?
Well, I think, you know, for people that really want to demonstrate that they agree with me, and I can tell you, we need 5,000 petition signatures in a relatively short period of time, and people were climbing all over each other to sign these petitions to get us on the line. And it's because people do recognize what a significant issue this is. There's so many things in our region that are going so well. Great institutions of higher learning. Although the city being an exception with respect to struggling school districts, some of the best school districts in the country, our healthcare systems, really world class. Where we fall down in terms of being competitive with the rest of the nation is in our tax climate, and we need to reverse that. I think we do that we have great potential for this region.
What's your deadline for getting that as a ballot line?
Well, the petitions have all been submitted. The deadlines have passed, and there's still opportunities to try to defeat the line, but I suspect that we'll be on the line along with my Democratic and Working Families lines as well.
All right, so that's the upstate tax relief ballot line that Senator O'Brien has been talking about. If you want to join the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994, right here in Rochester. You can also join the conversation on our social media, our Facebook pages, or at Evan Dawson on Twitter, where we've been getting a lot of interaction about a number of issues. So a good chance for you to interact with Senator Ted O'Brien on the issue of tax relief and poverty. Jane in Rochester wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, Mr. O'Brien.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. I'm a lifelong Democrat who is quite wobbly right now in terms of staying with the Democrats. When you talk about tax relief, I don't see that as inspiring people to come to Rochester or upstate because, as I've said repeatedly, Rochester is the second poorest nation in, second poorest city in the nation for a city its size. So why would anybody want to come here knowing how we neglect the poor? I'm not real interested in giving more to the haves and neglecting the have-nots, and that's going to lose the Democrats my vote anyway, their indifference to the poor. Thank you.
Well, Evan, the caller makes a great point, and what she's alluding to is a recent report that showed that for children living in poverty in the city of Rochester, we do rank among the worst in the nation, and then it's a huge problem. It affects the educational outcomes in the city that are disappointing, to say the least, and we need to do far better. Unfortunately, for many people, the tax climate does impact low-income and middle-income people even more dramatically in terms of ability to survive than others. And as an example, when the mayor comes to Albany and talks about need for AIM funding, the city of Rochester, annual household income of about $29,000 a year, there just isn't a room to pay more in property taxes for homeowners in the city of Rochester. And we need to find other ways to fund government. But the caller is right. We need to do more in terms of providing opportunity for people to get work training, work development, and renewed educational opportunities so that more people are enjoying success that only some people in our community are enjoying so far.
All right, so you touched on a couple of ways to ameliorate poverty. Is that at the top of the list, more work training? Give me what's the fastest, most effective way in your mind, the change or something that we can enact that would change poverty in our area?
Well, I think part of it is a funding issue, and some of the programs that we'll be working with United Way and hopefully get state funding for are a number of different programs, mentorships in schools, some of the things like Hillside Work Family Scholarship to get people engaged, but also efforts to curb teenage pregnancy, and then basic aid. So there's a whole range of things that we need to do. All of them, I think, related to educational outcomes in the city school district as well. People are living in broken homes. There's problems with drug addiction. And we need a comprehensive approach to tackle the problem of urban poverty in particular.
All right, let's get back to the phones. This is Dorothy in the city of Rochester, wants to talk about school districts, taxes, and more. Go ahead, Dorothy.
Hi, Evan. Mr. O'Brien.
Hello.
I was calling because I've generally supported most of your votes, but I have trouble. I come from out of state, and I come up to Rochester, and I love all that Rochester has to offer. But then when you talk about tax cuts, I wonder, how can we continue to offer things like our parks, our great libraries? City of Rochester does offer an excellent education, despite the challenges many of its students offer. You accepted it and talked about some of the suburban districts that have truly awesome, or at least their test scores are awesome, educational systems. But those are also the districts that have the highest taxes. So I wonder, I personally don't mind paying taxes for all this area has to offer. I have friends that have looked into moving down south to Georgia, but as soon as when they look there, they're not even looking at the school district, no matter how nice their suburb is, because they know they're going to have to go to a private school to get the education kids get in public schools here.
Right.
So I guess I want to know how you're going to maintain what brings people to Rochester if you're cutting all their taxes.
Well, I think one of the things you have to remember is that the property tax is a particularly regressive tax. And I've actually been at doors with people in tears because they weren't able to they're not finding ways to stay in their homes. And the property tax doesn't reflect the ability of somebody to pay. And it does have a disproportionate impact on low-income and middle-income people. And for those that can make choices, that have the means to live anywhere, represents a barrier there too. So I do think that the tax climate is something we need to address so that we can prosper as a region and focus on the kind of things we need to do to help more people with respect to workforce development, education, and a whole range of initiatives I was talking about. But we need to curb the property tax. And one of the ways to do that is starting getting serious about unfunded mandates. And that's why I've introduced something called the Unfunded Mandate Reform Act. It's carried by Assemblyman Morelli, the majority leader in the Assembly, and to try to tackle some of the root causes of our exploding tax climate in a way that won't cut essential services to people that depend on them.
Thank you, Dorothy, for the call. She's talking about getting a lot for your money. She's saying that if taxes are relatively high by comparison, but schools are great, you get a lot for your money, that some people don't mind it. It's the same kind of conversation you have with people who say, look, taxes are high, but you get a lot of house for your money up here. So, you know, Ted, how do you sort that out in your mind, saying taxes may be high, but you get a lot of house for your money, you get a lot for your taxes? You think there's a better balance that we can strike?
I think there is a better balance. And one of the things is, you know, although you can buy the housing stock relatively inexpensive, as you say, the difficulty is you can't ever pay your property taxes off. And what happens, some folks in more of the affluent areas of my district do recognize they're getting great bang for their property tax buck in private schools. But when their kids are through with school, oftentimes that's when they sell their house and leave. And so we have to be careful. It would really be great if we had a region where we are where people stay, and when their children get older, there's job opportunities for them here. And I think it's generally understood, at least it's my belief, that the biggest impediment to our job creation efforts has been the tax climate in New York. We need to create an environment where kids who graduate here stay here, earn a living here, raise their families here. That's the goal.
State Senator Ted O'Brien is our guest in studio for the hour, running for re-election and talking about many of the plans and policies that he would like to see go forward in Albany. He talked about unfunded mandates. We've heard a lot of people talking on the school side, and you've talked about schools and mandates now. That leads me to ask what you think about the GEA, the Gap Elimination Adjustment. We've heard from school districts that say, okay, around the financial crisis, around 2008, funding was cut for school districts. It was kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. When things get better, you'll get the funding restored. It has not been restored. School districts say that they are in a hardship. Do you agree with them, and would you restore the funding through GEA?
You know, that issue came up recently that I had an opportunity to weigh in a very public way, and that is that New York State gets some windfall money as a result of settlements with overseas banks. And
a few billion dollars, right? Billions,
yeah, and millions of dollars for New York State in particular. Just one bank, a Paris-based bank, the amount of money going to the New York State General Fund is $3 million. $3 billion.
Yes.
$3 billion just in that one settlement. And what I have proposed is that be used to eliminate the money that was taken from school districts when the recession hit. Before I was in the Senate, when the recession hit, the way that the books were balanced and we balanced the state budget was by taking money to a large degree from public education. Today, in this school year, budget year, we have not fully restored funding to public education at the levels we were when the recession hit 5 years ago. And I think both as a matter of our prior commitment, as a matter of equity, and because it's a public funding of public education has been a top priority for me, that I think we ought to use that bank settlement money to restore the funding fully. And then going forward, there's been projections that our budget will actually run surpluses. So this is the time to use the windfall to catch us back up and then maintain the level of funding that we have. And we've talked about property taxes being this big impediment. I have been in favor of the property tax cap. And you mentioned my opponent, Rich Funke, in his campaign Facebook site has said that he was critical of the property tax cap. But you talk to superintendents, even in towns where it's been very close to hitting their cap limits, or in some cases, like in West Rondequit, exceeding it, they wouldn't have a property tax cap problem if the gap elimination adjustment, this money taken away from school districts, was restored just to the levels they were 5 years ago. They wouldn't have a property tax cap problem for years. So it has been, public education is a priority for my funding priorities, and I think we do it with this windfall money and eliminate the gap elimination adjustment.
Your colleague in the Senate, Mike Nozzolio, a Republican, has said the same thing. We've heard some others talk about this. Why is, if there is some bipartisan support for this, why isn't it going to happen? I mean, I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but there's a lot of other proposals for what to do with this billions of dollars. What's the holdup here, and what do you foresee happening with this?
Well, I think, you know, the settlement monies came in after we were in session, you know, or it may have been something we were able to accomplish this last legislative session. But I think in the next session, this windfall money is here. The governor's indicated, had made some indications that education is a priority for him as well. I think it does get done. And there's been other windfall monies too. We do have other needs, but I think we start with a top priority being public education.
Let me grab Larry and Victor. Larry, thanks for calling Connections. You're on with Senator Ted O'Brien.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Senator O'Brien, I've always had this question, and maybe you can clear it up for me, but the unfunded mandates issue, people say, well, we want to eliminate that, and I guess I'm off the lowering taxes, but if the things that we're paying for now, wouldn't it just get pushed up to like the next level of government, and we'd be paying for it there?
Well, you know, not necessarily. And there's a wide range of things that constitute an unfunded mandate. And so, for example, like looking back on my days in the county legislature, if some towns have a board of supervisors, we have a county legislature, you are mandated to have, as a county government, one or the other. You have to have a county legislature. But in Monroe County, we have 29 county legislators. The mandate doesn't say how many you have to have. So even within mandated services that maybe make sense, there are still a lot of room for effectuating a common sense change that would constitute a big savings to taxpayers. So in the Monroe County Legislature, I said, okay, we have to have a county legislature. Let's cut it in half. Let's have 15 instead of 29 legislators, and I think we could still provide a valuable service that the county legislature provides. It's mandated, but we'd be do it in a much more cost-sensitive way for taxpayers.
Well, I think I remember when you proposed that, and I don't think that the opposition was saying that it was a mandate. I think they just were against it.
Well, I was not successful in advancing that particular cut, but I do think it's an illustration of the kinds of things, even when we look at the range of mandated services, it's oftentimes, if there are mandates that we can do away with that don't impact people's lives and people depend on services too dramatically, that's great. But even among those mandates that we continue, there still be efficiencies that we can find. And it's really important, if we're going to be serious about property tax relief, that we look at mandate relief.
Larry, thanks for the call. On Twitter, Dave says, the only way to lower property taxes is to fund more from Albany via the income tax, make the income tax more progressive. What do you think, Senator?
Well, it is a much more progressive tax, and I do think that that state aid is important to localities. So, you know, I use the illustration of the average household income in the city of Rochester being about $29,000 and people not being able to pay more. If you just wanted to use property taxes to raise it and you hit your 2% cap, you're talking about raising some $3 million in a structural budget deficit the city has year in year out, about $30 million. You just can't do it with property taxes. But the overall tax climate in New York needs really a real industry in trying to figure out how to do it better. And that's why we propose things like eliminating what's called the 18A energy tax. It's just a tax that goes to the general fund, appears on your utility bill. We've cut the manufacturer's tax for upstate manufacturers to zero. There's a lot of things that we need to do to make a more favorable climate without cutting the essential services that people rely on.
Let me grab another call. This is Bob in Mendon. Bob, thanks for calling Connections.
Sure. I'm curious. I know that our services are expensive, our taxes are expensive, but I don't think the services our taxes go to pay for are necessarily more expensive than elsewhere. So I'm curious how much of our money stays upstate in our taxes, and how much do we send downstate to help them out?
Well, you know, there is thanks for the call. There is a complaint that I hear frequently about how Rochester, for example, doesn't get its or our region doesn't get its fair share of state resources. And one of the thing, one of those measures is something called AIM funding or aid to municipalities. We're able at budget time to get a little bit of a extra bonus for Rochester this year, but it really it really has been some real inequities. And, of course, the governor proposes his executive budget. Then each house, the Senate and the Assembly, weigh in and introduce their own budgets. And at that point, I advocated as loudly as I could for aid to municipalities to be increased for our region. Unfortunately, the Senate Republicans, who controlled this year's budget, included $200 million in AIM funding for New York City, zero increase in AIM funding for upstate New York. And I just found that unconscionable and couldn't support the one house budget.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Appreciate that. On Thursday on this program, at noon, we're going to have Zephyr Teachout back on the show. I wonder, she's running for governor in the Democratic primary against incumbent Andrew Cuomo. Ted, have you met Zephyr Teachout?
I have not, Evan.
You haven't met her.
I have not met her, but I guess that's not particularly unusual.
No, especially she's not in politics. Now, she's a Fordham Law professor. So I'm curious, are you supporting Governor Cuomo's reelection?
Yes. Yeah, I think, you know, the governor has been, I think, appropriately focused on upstate New York right from the first State of the State address and his budget addresses, has really focused on upstate and the need to be of great assistance to upstate New York. I think that's entirely right. Unfortunately, I think the Senate Republican majority has diluted the emphasis on upstate. And you look at like the manufacturer's tax credit I was talking about, now expanded across the state rather than being maybe more impactful, but just upstate New York. We talked about AIM funding, where partly maybe because of a coalition with breakaway Democrats, they focused more on New York City than upstate. And on public education funding, and in the Senate One House bill that was proposed by the Senate majority added more funding for largely New York City charter schools than for public education statewide. So there's a lot more that we need to do. I think the governor started us out on the right track. I think he's doing a lot of good things for upstate, and I'm supportive of his candidacy.
The Moreland situation doesn't bother you?
Well, the Moreland situation, I think it's important to reflect on how that came about. The governor didn't want to go Moreland Commission, but could not get an ethics reform package through the state Senate. Democrats proposed a whole series of reform packages. Senate Republicans would not budge on any of the reasonable reforms that were suggested. So the governor said, you know, I'm going to do a Moreland Commission unless you get something done. And we didn't do it in the Senate, in spite of my best efforts. So we had to do the Moreland Commission. I think that the end result of that may put us in a good place. All of the files have been turned over to the U.S. attorney. If there are things that need to be prosecuted on either side of the aisle in any office, I think those should be pursued. And I think the U.S. attorney's office has indicated that they intend to. So I think the end result potentially leaves us in a good place in terms of rooting out corruption and the ethical lapses that we continue to see in Albany.
Yeah, certainly Preet Bharara has said that he will continue to focus on what Moreland might have continued with had they continued as a commission. What the New York Times reported on regarding Larry Schwartz and other people in the governor's office potentially intervening and trying to keep the commission away from people close to him, did that bother you?
Well, I only know enough about it, what I've read in the Times as well. And, you know, this was the governor put together this commission. But I think, you know, the accusation in the Times was with respect to whether or not subpoenas would be issued. The end result is the subpoenas were, in fact, issued. So I don't think that I think the Moreland Commission, while it was active, demonstrated independence. And and I think, again, the end result is going to be that the U.S. attorney is going to follow up all those leads. I think they should. Those ethical lapses are unconscionable for public servants serving in Albany. And I hope that this next session, the Senate will embrace many of the legislative initiatives that we tried to push through last time.
94 years since women got the right to vote in this country. It's sort of amazing that it hasn't even been 100 years yet. And So we're going to be talking about the Women's Equality Agenda. We're going to be talking about, well, you might have heard of Hobby Lobby and some things in the wake of Hobby Lobby that Senator O'Brien has been talking about. Before we do that, we're going to get to that in just a second. Let me take one more call, and then we'll shift gears with Senator O'Brien. Let me grab Tim in Pittsford, who still wants to talk about taxes. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, guys. I'll just lay out my situation quick. My wife and I live in Pittsford. We're told we're upper middle class, although we don't feel like it most of the time. But I want to know, what if there's unfunded mandates, say there's some relief there, what's the real effect it's going to have on us? Because if we pay off our mortgage right now, our tax bill every month is still going to be over $900. And, you know, we've got friends down in North Carolina, I'm sure you've heard of before, $300,000 houses, and our total tax bill is less than $2,000. You know, what are we supposed to do? I mean, we're leaving when our kids graduate college or trade school, but we don't want to leave. But how much of an effect is this really going to have? Because that's, I mean, our tax bill is more than we pay in our mortgage right now.
And Tim,
we're struggling. I mean, we can do it, but we're kind of struggling sometimes. How much relief is that going to be? I mean, does all of a sudden our tax bill every year go from $10,000 to $9,500, or is there some real savings there?
I think it's a good question. Go ahead, Ted.
And Tim, this is exactly the point I started out with. And as I was saying, your situation is unfortunately not the exception. It's becoming the rule. I talked about my own next door neighbor who is exactly in the situation you are, where he knows that there are other options around the nation where living expenses and property taxes are much, much, much less, and has made the decision to leave. That's something you're struggling with now. And, you know, we've done some good things. I've been in the Senate for 2 years. We've provided $1.5 billion in property tax relief this year. So the needle has moved in the right direction. But there's so much more to be done before we really make our region more competitive with the rest of the country. And I do think that if, you know, we can continue with state aid, we can continue trying to provide property tax relief. But to be serious about it, we do have to look at the expense of unfunded mandates. And because an unfunded mandate is a mandated service that the state doesn't provide aid for, so it rests on local property taxpayers to make the difference. And I do think that looking at unfunded mandates can be impactful and actually can reduce your property tax bill. It's awful difficult, to be candid, to do it in 1 year or in a short period of time. It's going to be take time, but we need to start that effort now and before so much of our talented workforce decides that they do have greener pastures and leave our area. The tax burden is really one that we need to address, because people like Tim are understanding they have options and could live in other parts of the country less expensively. It's something that's a top priority for me.
Tim, it sounds like the point is, if you've got a $10,000 tax bill, it's not going to go from $10,000 to $6,000 overnight. It may go from $10,000 to $9,500 to $9,000 if they get their ways here. Any quick follow-up here before we grab our break?
Well, the one thing I was going to say is I'm getting tired of hearing, I mean, we live in Pittsford, so we have literally some of the best schools in the country. There's got to be some happy medium between, you know, I'm tired of hearing, well, you've got some of the best schools in the country. There shouldn't be an $8,000 tax difference between where we live and, say, down in the Carolinas or something. I mean, that argument's getting old. Well, you've got great schools. Well, you know, I've talked to my friends down there, and they say they have to be a little choosier about the district that they're in, but it's not like they're sending their kids to these awful schools. I mean, something's got to give.
Thanks, Tim.
Right. I think that's right, Tim. And, you know, we clearly have work to do. Part of it is the mandates we place on school districts in terms of even curriculum and a lot of things. What we are acquiring being taught in the classrooms. There's big opportunity for us to make the school districts' lives easier, because what has happened in this current climate is you've got local property taxes, taxpayers in this big tension, this big conflict with our local school districts, and that shouldn't happen. You know, we've got to find other ways to fund education, and we have to find ways, just for one illustration, you live in Pittsford, wonderfully performing school district, as you suggest. They're graduating 99% of their students. They're all college ready, but they have to establish compliance with state educational requirements the same as a non-performing. There ought to be some thresholds, and state education department could establish them. But right now, the superintendent of schools, Mike Pirro in Pittsford, tells me they're spending better than $300,000, more than $250,000 a year, just on establishing compliance with state directives. That's money that doesn't go to educate one single kid. And it's for a district that is clearly performing as one of the best districts in the nation. So there ought to be some threshold. State ed could establish them where they get some relief from establishing compliance when they're educationally succeeding. Not all districts need to be treated the same. That would provide relief for Pittsford and free up state money to go to districts that aren't performing as well. So there's a lot of analysis that we need to do and a lot of hard work to bring about a change. And you talked about really wanting change to come quickly. I don't know that that some great transformation can happen, but I can tell you that bringing about change takes hard work, and we have to stay at it and really focus first by understanding the nature of the problem and then working to resolve them.
All right, we're going to take the shortest break in radio. We've got your phone calls lined up. We're going to shift the conversation to the Women's Equality Agenda and more on the 94th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. Ted O'Brien, the senator, is in studio with us, running for re-election this year against Rich Funke, who will be in studio with us, we hope, next week here. Your calls next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, we sit down with Dr. Walter Bumpus, the president and CEO of the American Association of Community Colleges. He's talking about improving college readiness of high school graduates. Then we hear from a panel that is helping lead a community forum about the state's new medical marijuana legislation. It's all coming up Wednesday on Connections with Evan Dawson.
This is WXXI AM Rochester and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connection. State Senator Ted O'Brien's in studio with us. On the line, we've got Barbara Lee Savoy, who is the director of the Women and Gender Studies Program at the College of Brockport. Dr. Lee Savoy, nice to have you back on the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much. Happy to be there.
It's a big day. 94 years since. Do you want to give us the quick history lesson, Dr. Lee Savoy?
Well, I mean, it's a very important, significant day in the passing of the 19th Amendment and giving women access to vote. And so I think it's a really important conversation to step back and say that, you know, we've worked really hard to get to this point, but we still have a long road ahead. And I also want to say that 94 years, that's not too long ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's much less than half the history of the country so far that women have been allowed to vote, which is a really remarkable idea. So Senator O'Brien, and we'll get Dr. Lisa Voice's take on some of these issues as well. I know you have been looking at the Women's Equality Agenda for quite some time. It's been at loggerheads in Albany. Where does it stand now, and what would you want voters to consider when they think about these issues going forward?
Well, first, let me wish a happy Women's Equality Day to Barbara. Hello, Doctor. I hope you're having a good Women's Equality Day.
Thanks so much, Senator O'Brien, and pleasure for me to be speaking with you again.
Thanks. Yes, I think with respect to, you know, the Women's Equality Act did not, we did not able to get all 10 points passed in the Senate as they were in the Assembly, and as a result, there was nothing to send to the governor for signature. The big holdup is with respect to the 10th point, the reproductive choice point. And unfortunately, that holdup is because of a position that's been embraced by my opponent this year. You mentioned Mr. Funke being in next week, who believes that that 10th point, which is a codification of Roe v. Wade, is not acceptable. And it really saddens me that we are holding up things like equal pay for equal work and sexual discrimination in all workplaces or reforming of that and all of the points. Because of an insistence that we take away rights that women have in New York right now with respect to reproductive choice. We need to Mr. Funke's position and that of the Senate Republican majority has been that if we don't take away reproductive choice and refuse to codify Roe v. Wade in New York state law, that you can't have all the rest of these 9 points as well. And I think that's a position that's far to the right of most New Yorkers, even far to the right of most Republicans in New York. And as is really an unfortunate circumstance that's given us this logjam.
Dr. Lisa Voy, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, well, I just want to reiterate that we need all points of the women's equality agenda. So this one point, you know, looking at this one point as the point that's in the way is problematic. And I do think that it's very similar to thinking along the lines of, if we go back to suffrage and women earning the right to voice, we have a large number of men who are making these decisions that are really dictating women's reproductive health choices. And the more that we place restrictions on women's reproductive health, the more we introduce problems. And those that tend to be most concerned with point 10 of this agenda tend to be the ones that are really in the space of anti-abortion. And I want to say, the moment that we start putting restrictions on women's access to reproductive health and reproductive health choices, we increase the likelihood that women, and a very small percentage of women, are accessing abortion, and that number will increase.
But Dr. Lisa Voy, you know, those who oppose that one piece of the 10 have said that, you know, at the very least, we can get 9 of the 10 points through. Mm-hmm. And and Ted's been on this program talking about this before. We've had others talking about mm-hmm. this before. Brian Kolb has been on this program talking about it before. Mm-hmm. And the question is, why not get those other 9 out of 10 done? And Dr. Lisa Voy, I'll ask you first, and then I'll ask the man who works in Albany on that issue. But those other 9 points matter to the women's equality movement.
I mean, the points do matter. So I think that's a really important point that we raised. But I think it's problematic when we start partitioning out pieces of this act. We need the whole act, and to start putting something that continues to make women vulnerable is problematic. And I think the history tells us that we continue to get our needs met in increments, tiny pieces of the pie. And I think the liberal feminist movement is miraculous in having achieved those little incremental steps. But to once again step aside and compromise our health is problematic for me.
Ted, I know you've essentially made that same point here, but there hasn't been a solution in Albany. We've seen several years go by, and it's the same debate, and nothing gets passed.
Well, you know, in the Senate, of course, the first 9 points have been passed, not only this past session but the session before. But to get something to the governor to sign into law, we have to replicate what was done in the Assembly. And you know, my opponent is one who has accused me of playing politics with this issue. But our option as senators is to replicate what's been done in the Assembly. That would mean embracing the 10th point, which is reproductive choice. And the insistence by the Republican majority that we need to take away, remember, they're talking about taking away rights that women have in New York right now. Mm-hmm. The 10th point is substantively 2 sentences. It's a codification of Roe v. Wade and the case law, the federal case law that flows from Roe v. Wade. Those are rights that women have now. They can make their own reproductive health choice. They don't need politicians standing between them and their doctor and the person that they turn to faith decisions. They don't need politicians interceding there, and to insist that you can't have the other 9 points unless you give up rights that you have now, that women have now in New York, to me it's unconscionable.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Senator O'Brien, can you talk for a moment, and maybe you have already mentioned this, and I was teaching earlier today, so I wasn't able to listen to the prior conversation, but can you speak for a moment on the contraceptive disclosure bill? Is that still a possibility as a stopgap while we're trying to get this 10th point?
Yeah, we hadn't been able to address that just yet, and of course, unfortunately, now we're not in session. When we go back to session, it's going to be a top priority for my conference, and you know, hopefully we can come back in a time when we would be in the majority, which would be great for all kinds of reasons, including a contraceptive disclosure bill, it brings us to this whole discussion of the Hobby Lobby decision and why this is so important. And we have to remember that we have a Supreme Court that very well could overturn rights that women enjoy in New York. That's why it's so important that we codify this in New York state law now. But if we do come back in the majority, there's an interesting additional bonus. For the first time in the history of the state of New York, in either the Assembly or the Senate, we'll have a majority leader that is a woman, and Andrea Stewart-Cousins, our leader in the Democratic Conference. It, far, far too long, as it's way overdue. But with Andrea's leadership, New York would be in a great place.
Go ahead, Barb.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, it kind of circles back around. When you look at the other 9 points, I mean, they're such important pieces, but the moment that we start thinking about ending discrimination in hiring and ending discrimination in sexual harassment and looking at human trafficking, and as we go down, you know, point 1 through 10, I mean, it's ludicrous to say, oh, well, let's pass, you know, all points but 10, because it is something that when we think about women's reproductive health, it intersects the other points. It's a huge aspect of our lives. So it's such an important piece that we should not be really marginalizing this or putting it to the side as less important.
Let me grab another phone call here, and we've got several lined up here. This is Barbara in Penfield. Barbara, thanks for calling Connections. You're on with Senator Ted O'Brien. Go ahead.
Well, hello, and happy Women's Equality Day to everybody. I think we should make this a national holiday, especially in the birthplace of Susan B. Anthony. And I can't help but think how Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and other suffragists would be amazed at how maybe how little women are using the vote for their issues, that all 10 points of the Women's Equality Act, of what Barbara just went over, and Senator O'Brien, that we are still working for those. And I think they would say, as I say, you know, let's just get out and vote. And, you know, and vote. I think if women, you know, got more excited and learned more about these issues and, you know, and get them to the polls, we have such a not only just women, but everybody, a bad record of voting. I do think that's one of our things. But in addition to this, Senator O'Brien, I want to thank you very much for your support. I'm a very active, Senator knows me, I'm Barbara Moore, I'm a very active member of the NOW chapter, the National Organization for Women, and I'm very pleased to report that this weekend, the state PAC, the NOW New York State PAC, voted to endorse Senator O'Brien. You've done wonderful work for us. You're always out there at the forefront talking about our issues and voting for us, and we really do appreciate it, and I want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Barbara. Thank you for encouraging people to exercise the right to vote, first of all. And yes, the NOW endorsement means so much to me. I was just so grateful to receive that. And and I won't let you down, Barbara. I'm going to keep working hard.
Totally.
I know you will. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Barbara.
Yeah, and I just want to say that the semester is just underfoot on my campus, and we're absolutely, you know, making students aware is a really important piece, and it's an activist arm to our discipline. So totally support Barbara's words, and we do want to make sure that we exercise our rights.
Let me get back to the phones. And again, if we've got Senator Ted O'Brien, his opponent, Rich Funke, is going to be in studio with us next month, and we expect early next month. This is... Oh, I'm trying to make sure I've got them in correct order. This is Tom in Fairport. Tom, thanks for calling Connections. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. We hear a lot about these unfunded mandates, but a lot of times there's no specifics offered in how, you know, what mandates can be cut and all that kind of stuff. The thing that's really driving property taxes up in New York State is state public pensions, especially for teachers and public employees. I'd like to hear what Senator O'Brien plans to do to try to manage that situation. I mean, we have a situation in the city, I believe, where they're borrowing money to pay pensions, and it just seems ludicrous.
Well, you know, that's a problem that the governor in a prior legislature took on with respect to the passage of Tier 6. I am not someone that believes we can disrupt contractual arrangements that predate the, so we're really talking about employees entering the system going forward, and so there has been an attempt to deal with the issue that the caller addresses. But that's one of a whole range of things, and our problems are largely due to the fact that we have so many mandates on business, on local government, on local school districts, and there's a whole range of things that we need to attack. I don't think there's one panacea for our property tax burden. It's going to take a lot of hard work and addressing a whole litany of mandates that add to the cumulative problem we now have in the state, which is a tax climate that's just as untenable.
Tom, thanks for the call. This is Molly in Brighton. Molly, go ahead.
Hello, everyone. I heard the senator said several times that we need money for funding education. And I have a suggestion. It's out of the box, of course, but completely compliant with the exceptionalism of America. I would like to suggest this, that the federal government allows every single state to print their own money for just the purpose of education, funding education. And this, that money could only be used within the state.
Well, I, you know, that would be something I'd have to research. I'm sorry to say, Molly, that I don't have familiarity with the proposals that you're talking about. So I'm not sure what the impact of printing our own money would be.
Familiar with it. However, I'm suggesting that the federal government allows each state to print their own money to fund education, because education is so essential. Actually, I would even go further and say for the healthcare also, but I'll stick for now to the education. And that would help, because it would save you money. You could spend, you could then decrease taxes in other areas and take care of the other mandates you have.
Molly, let me jump in and say, first of all, thanks for the call. Second of all, your passion on the issues is obvious. And third of all, as an idea, it's not going to get very far. We're just not going to be printing money that is only allowed use for one reason. However, Ted, earmarking happens. And, you know, I think maybe that's more along the lines of a possibility when you start earmarking funds or you know, mandating funds moving to this pile or that pile. But some people get queasy about the word mandates, I guess, as well.
Well, you know, I do think that Molly and I have one thing in common, and that is come budget time, that education has to be a top priority for us at as we decide how to slice up the state revenues. And public education has been at the top of my list for a long time.
Dr. Lee Savoy, again, we've got Dr. Barbara Lee Savoy on the line, the director of the Women and Gender Studies Program at the College of Brockport. Before we start to wrap up with Senator O'Brien, let me wrap up the conversation with you on the 94th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment with a question that I don't know if you have an exact number or figure, and I don't have it in front of me, but we've been talking about women voting, no matter what your issues are, women understanding the need to vote, all of us understanding the need to vote. What percentage of women who are registered, well, what percentage of women register and what percent of registered women do vote? I mean, is it roughly similar to men? Is it much less or more? Give me a sense for what it is.
No, it's not a piece of data that I have in front of me, so I'd be hesitant to, you know, jump at a response. But I do want to argue that voting, I think when we think about voting, I want to make one important point that I raised, you know, maybe last week, is that I think bodies deceive. So, you know, some of the best allies could be men, they could be queer, they could be gay, they could be straight, they could be women, they could be anyone. And I think the important point here is to recognize, you know, we all have voice. So as citizens, we should make use of that and exercise our rights to vote. I think women, and clearly the women that are, you know, I'm, you know, engaged in my work, we're all active, engaged citizens who are concerned about these issues. And so we are exercising our rights to vote. But I think everybody has that responsibility to be able to be informed and to understand the importance of this.
Always nice to talk to you, Dr. Lee Savoy. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much. And thank you, Senator O'Brien. Grateful for your work.
Thank you, Doctor. I'm grateful for yours.
All right. That's Dr. Barbara Lee Savoy, the director of the Women and Gender Studies Program at the College at Brockport, joining us on the line on a day of significance, certainly, for women around the country. Again, if you're just joining us, Senator Ted O'Brien in studio. His opponent, Rich Funke, is going to join me later, we think early next month, and we'll certainly give you access to all the candidates here. A couple more things to ask about here. Ted, we've got tomorrow on this program, we're talking about medical marijuana. There's a forum tomorrow. Does implementation need to be expedited for medical marijuana? It would, right now it's on track to start around January 2015. Does it need to be expedited?
That's right, Evan. The legislation that we passed authorizing medical marijuana gives the Department of Health an opportunity to put implementation regulations in place, and they can take it up to 18 months to do that. The governor recently announced that he has directed the Department of Health to look at, particularly for children suffering with seizure disorders or epilepsy, where there's some studies from around the world show that treatment with medical marijuana can have some efficacy, that is asking the Department of Health to see if there's ways to expedite that for those children whose suffering could be alleviated now, and of course the angst that parents feel when their children are suffering.
Sure.
So I do think that there are there will be specific areas where maybe we can expedite the process for specific ailments.
And just about 90 seconds left here. Unshackle Upstate gave you an 83% rating for what it's worth. That's a pro-business group in upstate New York. They've been on this program talking about their desire to see changes. For example, wicks and scaffold laws. We've got Labor Day coming up. Those are big issues for labor. Wicks and scaffold, for example. Keep, reform, or scrap them?
Well, I think we're upstate, at, Unshackle Upstate and I have some commonality. Some common interests are really with respect to tax relief. But by the same time, we are very careful when we talk about undoing labor protections, which often are there for very important reasons. And so I think we want to be very cautious. So it's not the Unshackle Upstate agenda is not one I can embrace in its totality. But with respect to tax relief in particular, I think we see eye to eye on those kinds of issues.
All right. And 30 seconds left. What is, when you talk to voters, what's the first question you get most often, or the first issue they bring up most often?
The biggest issue is property taxes, to be perfectly frank. And I couldn't tell you what the second biggest issue was, but I can tell you the first.
Taxes is that big an issue.
Property taxes is a big issue because people really are feeling, like our caller today said, look, I could go to other parts of the country, and the property tax burden is just too overwhelming here in New York. It's an issue that we really have to address, and I'm committed to doing it.
State Senator Ted O'Brien joining us in studio for the hour, taking a lot of your calls. We appreciate all of the interaction with our listeners online and on the program today. We'll have Ted's opponent on the show soon. Always nice to see you, Senator. Thank you for taking the time for us.
Thanks so much, Evan. It's great to be here.
John Andrus is our engineer. Did a great job today with all those phone calls. Thank you, John. Appreciate that. And thank you for listening. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Member Supported Public Radio.